Welcome, everyone, to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. In the second of our two-part discussion with Sir Paul Tucker, we will be discussing his most recent book, Global Discord. In the book, Sir Tucker aims to address a vital question: can the international economic system survive today's fractured geopolitics? Democracies are facing a drawn-out contest with authoritarian states that is entangling much of public policy. And Sir Tucker lays out principles for a sustainable system of international cooperation, showing how democracies can deal with China and other illiberal states without sacrificing their deepest political values. Drawing on three decades as a central banker and regulator, Sir Tucker applies these principles to the international monetary order, including the role of the U.S. dollar, trade and investment regimes, and the financial system. Combining history, economics, and political and legal philosophy, Sir Tucker offers a new account of international relations, rejecting intellectual traditions that go back to Hobbes and Kant, and instead deploying ideas from David Hume and Bernard Williams. Tucker describes a new kind of political realism that emphasizes power and interests without sidelining morality. He says incentives must be aligned with values if institutions are to endure. The connecting tissue for a system of international cooperation, he writes, should be legitimacy, thus creating a world of concentric circles in which we cooperate more with those with whom we share the most and whom we fear the least. Sir Tucker, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Edward. It's very good to be here.
So to kick us off and help lay the groundwork for the book, why don't we have you talk a little bit about some of the current vulnerabilities and design flaws you see in the governance of our current system of international institutions?
Well, thank you very much. I think perhaps the best way of putting it is after the Second World War, when, you know, thank God, the United States had helped sustain civilization in all the best senses, it was inevitable that a new world order, a new world system of policy regimes be configured largely in the image of the United States, or the image of the United States and European traditions that kind of run through the United States. And I think looking back, particularly after the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s, there was a kind of presumption that to the extent that there were new rising states, new powers, they would kind of be like us, that they would have the same kind of deep values as us. And I think this can be illustrated concretely. So take the World Trade Organization, and it's the last part of this story that's really important. So the World Trade Organization is set up, China joins, and then it turns out that China is using its state-owned enterprises to subsidize exports, to make its exports cheaper. And the United States objects to this and says, well, that's illegal. You're not allowed to go around subsidizing exports under the WTO treaty. So you've either got to stop, or alternatively, we, the United States, are entitled to employ what are termed countervailing measures, which all that means is introducing tariffs. So Chinese subsidies bring down the cost of their exports, and American tariffs push them back up.
Right.
China takes the United States to the WTO dispute process. It goes all the way through the process, and it reaches the appellate board, which is like the Supreme Court of the World Trade System. And the case turns on, well, our state-owned enterprises, public bodies, public policy bodies, and actually they're not part of the central government. And the appellate body decides, no, they're not. And so the subsidies are illegal. Now, in one sense, this is just crazy. This is a one-party state, and everything reflects the will or acquiescence of the central party apparatus. So this is an extraordinary decision, but it's the decision, and that's final. Here's where the sting comes. This happens in politics, it happens domestically. And what typically happens is that there would be, that would be the decision of the case looking backwards, but we would change the law going forwards, that if you like, Washington and Beijing would sit down and bargain. Maybe the EU and perhaps even Japan would be there as the other really big trading powers. And some kind of bargain would be reached, and no one would be completely happy, but no one would be completely fed up. But that can't be done, because to push a new rule through the WTO, everybody has a veto. Every member of the WTO, hundreds of them, they have a veto. And you think, well, that's a pretty crazy system in circumstances like that. Maybe we should change the rule and remove the veto for some purposes. Well, you can't do that because everybody's got a veto over the, the rules. And so the sin here that I want to bring out, this, by the way, is in, I think, chapter 17 of my book. The point I want to bring out is not that the appellate board did a bad job, although I happen to think that they did. It's that when the WTO treaty was agreed, it's a kind of end of history point. It was, well, everyone's just going to be like us. Everyone's going to agree that the trading regime should be a liberal trading regime.
Right.
Everybody is going to have the same system of government than us. Or if they don't, they're going to be small and they won't matter very much. Whereas here we have I'm not attributing at this point any ill intent to China or any aggression to China, just a country with a completely different approach to governing itself and to international affairs. And therefore, we have a treaty that just isn't tailored to cope with the world in which we live. And that just runs. There are other examples in other fields, just mentioning it very briefly. In the IMF, the US and Europe have a lot more votes than China. Now, we don't have much incentive to change that, which we'll come on to, but we live in an international world made in the image of the Western powers. Yeah, it's a good thing if you're from the West. It's not a good thing if you're from elsewhere. And they are real powers now, and there are going to be more of them. And so life has become a lot more complicated.
You note in the book that under hegemony, whether regional or global, the big issue is whether a given system's design is imposed or accepted. The hegemon might be capable of coercing others to help provide public goods, but at the risk of damaging its authority if it relies too heavily on imperial power. My question is, do you think that most of today's international systems were created and are still subject to the U.S.'s hegemonic power? Or do you think that there's some sort of legitimate hierarchy where the U.S.'s influence actually benefits all parties?
I think both, actually. I think an important thing for Europeans to recognize is that after the Second World War, in many respects, we outsourced our defense to you. This is a good deal for us. In some respects, we have more leisure time and we produce more consumption goods because you're so busy producing military goods.
Right.
What do you get? You get, your elite gets to enjoy being top dog, and it kind of matters a lot that the regular American people feel proud about you being the leading country in the world. Now, I think that's instructive because I don't think particularly that the U.S. has imposed terrible things on Europe. In fact, the United States made lots of compromises in the late 1940s and early 1950s, partly because of the looming Cold War. But, you know, you didn't impose your views. So Europe and the United States irritate each other occasionally and actually tend to get that irritation out of perspective in the short run. But on the whole, this has been a system that suits everybody. For the rest of the world, of course, parts of it haven't been so comfortable. But nevertheless, it is a system in which when China was allowed in, they thrived. And it is an extraordinary thing that hundreds of millions of people have been brought out of poverty. And they weren't brought out of poverty by communist system of economic organization, but something vaguely like us. But it would be, and I think it was naive to think that economic liberalization in China would lead inexorably to political liberalization. I don't think it was a crazy thought that it might, but I think it was wishful thinking to think that it certainly would. And one of the messages of the book is just avoid wishful thinking. I mean, at the very least, one would expect the party in China to want to hold on to its power. Well, that's not political liberalization. And, you know, you can get that far without being at all critical of China. Just, well, you know, that's how one would expect it to be. Now, if you, I think this contest between the West and China will go on for about a century or more. During that time, other great powers will most probably emerge, most likely India, conceivably Indonesia. And as time goes on, the world is going to be less and less like the world immediately after the Second World War, or the world immediately after the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s. And it'll be a bit more like the 18th century and the 19th century with lots of major powers. And they will, I come back to the same point. That's a world where peaceful coexistence in the world as a whole is going to rely on those powers, that new top table, finding some accommodation with each other. That will be harder if every state in the world, however small, has a veto. And actually, it's in the interests of the small countries to give up their veto on some fronts, but in their medium-term interests, not in their short-term interests. So the other thing I want to say at this stage is I think, if anything, there was a phase of triumphalism in the West. I'm not sure that it was kind of triumphalism in, if you like, psychological intent, but it was a liberalism that was universalist. Everyone should be like us, rather than we could have a pluralist liberalism where people get there under their own steam. Something I'm impressed by in my country's 19th century history, when we were the top dog, is certain major figures saying people find their own way to liberty, rather than, you know, we're not going to send them a cookbook through the post.
Right.
and I think people in Washington kind of lost sight of that for a while.
Yeah, that's true. You know, with regard to China, you say in the book that it very much matters how China thinks about the order that has prevailed since World War II. And you also note that the PRC's rise has not come through war, but commerce. And the tradable currency of international power is no longer swappable territories, but partly the pecking order and institutionalized hierarchies, helping to explain Beijing's preoccupation with its voting weight at the IMF and other tables. Do you think that with China's rise, the foundations of international order have been or perhaps, you know, will be reconfigured?
Yes, eventually, somehow. And I think that we have to be very careful not to lose ourselves in this process. There's a kind of trope of what are known as realist international relations scholars that it's all about survival of the state. Well, yeah, actually, it's about survival of ways of life, and therefore it's about values as well as just. I mean, you know, if people don't believe in the legitimacy of their state, they're not going to support the survival of their state. In some ways, you see this in France during the middle of the 20th century. So we're going to have to adapt, but we have to adapt in ways where we don't lose ourselves. It's kind of compromise where it is respectful of their way of life, but most of all tries to preserve our way of life. Let me give you a concrete example. I mean, of course, China is going to object to the US having a veto on everything big at the IMF. And actually, if the Europeans all vote together, they've got a veto at the IMF as well. And they can say, well, it's objectionable that these institutions are still kind of Western institutions. But given what's been going on in China, given the aggression they show towards some of their neighbors, the assertiveness in the South China Sea, the way they've presented the renminbi as a kind of rival to the dollar, it's not at all obvious that the West should roll over and say, okay, we'll give up those rights at the IMF. I don't think the West should do that. I think in some respects, I think China could have played a better game from their point of view. They weren't patient enough for long enough, but we are all where we are. So we need to find a way of somehow maintaining peaceful coexistence. And nevertheless, working together where it's possible to work together. And that's going to be hard. I mean, for what it's worth, I think this contest is going to go on for a long century. I think the parallels drawn between the Second German Reich and my country, Britain, at the turn of the 20th century, I think they're not, of course, there's some illumination from that, but I don't think there's a great deal of illumination. I think much more instructive is the struggle between Britain and France from roughly 1689 to 1815. Why? The beginning of the 18th century, Britain is resisting universal absolutist monarchy. And at the end of the 18th century, Britain is resisting universalist absolutist revolution. But actually what we're resisting is absolutism. And in other words, there's a big ideological difference. And there's a big ideological difference now between the West and the People's Republic. So we need to find, there will be some decoupling of the global economy. That is already happening. I mean, I wrote this book before it started happening. I thought it would happen, and I thought it needed to happen. People now call it friendshoring. I certainly didn't invent that, but I kind of certainly had the thought. Don't be overly dependent on essential things, on people that don't wish you well.
Right.
But that risks overshooting, of course, and that we end up in a completely bifurcated economy. And, you know, that would make everybody poorer. But we need to manage risk. Let me give you a concrete example. A few weeks ago, the head of the IMF said, well, already what's happening, decoupling, is going to reduce global GDP, global income, by $1.5 trillion. That's a very big number. But actually, it's only about 1% to 1.5% of global income. And given, let's assume that world economy grows at around 3% each year, that's about 6 months' growth. And if you said, well, are you prepared to give up 6 months' growth in order to reduce the probability of, to put it extravagantly, war by X percent? I mean, X doesn't have to be very big to say, yeah.
Right.
6 months' growth, I'll trade that in to reduce the probability of conflict. I think something follows from this, by the way, is that policymakers can't be siloed anymore. They need to be sensitive. Everything now has a read across to security issues.
Right. Right. Well, what do you think China really wants as it relates to the international landscape? We learned through the leaked document 9 and its 7 no's that China wants to be nothing like the West. Should we take the view that China has a desire to reshape international organizations to help them become a regional or global hegemon, or maybe that they reject international institutions of the West outright and want to create their own international political order? Or is it, you know, perhaps that they are content with the status quo so long as the U.S. and others respect that they are and will continue to be an illiberal state seeking leadership in a liberal world? I mean, what do you think? What do you think that they really want?
First of all, Edward, I'm really pleased that you picked up on Document 9 and the Seven No's. This book's now been out for a month and a half, and I've been lucky enough to be invited to present it in various places. And I've kind of almost done a hands up. How many people have heard of Document 9? Relatively few people have. And if my book widens awareness of Document 9 and the Seven No's, I think that's a worthwhile thing in itself. Well,
for sure.
So they want to be preeminent in their regional sphere. They want Taiwan to be under their direct control. But I don't think it can just be that. I mean, if China were I'm not putting a probability on this, but if China were aggressively to try to take Taiwan against the wishes of the Taiwanese people or most of the Taiwanese people, and the West did nothing, then I don't think we should assume that Japan and South Korea, or most significantly, parts of Southeast Asia, Northern Australia, could remain comfortable in their own kind of liberal lifestyle. I think, by the way, in passing, as I was writing the book, I ended up thinking it was tremendously important that nothing I'm saying is about Chinese people or the Confucian heritage. I mean, South Korea especially, but Japan too, show that you can have a Confucian heritage and honor and live by that heritage and those traditions, and yet also have constitutional democracy and elections where there are real transfers of power from one party and another. But against that, some people say, well, actually, in Confucianism, you can find values that are very close to what we regard as basic human rights. But they've never run through Chinese institutions in the world. So there is a real contrast there. So what does China want? Well, it wants to be a regional power, and if it wants to be a regional power, there are some commentators, learned commentators, that say, but there's no evidence that wants any more. To which my response is, but how? Why on earth should Chinese leaders today know what their successors will want in 25 years' time, or even what they themselves will want in 15 years' time? And if they had wanted to integrate their way into a liberal world, but with slightly greater regional power, they haven't gone about it in a way that is reassuring to Japan and South Korea, Vietnam, a kind of communist state in some respects, and other parts of Southeast Asia. So I think I think the robust assumption is to think about what do we need to do to minimize the costs to our way of life if China ends up being very ambitious. And I think it is plausible that they will end up being very ambitious. But we need to the extent that we take that approach in the West, which really means Washington, Berlin, Paris, and London, but these days with Delhi and Canberra, we need to do that in a way that doesn't necessarily make the world a more risky place than it already is. So this is a really big ask. I mean, you know, the stakes are... I mean, the United States, and of course, on a lesser scale, my country, have had all sorts of domestic problems. And there's lots of frustration with our politicians, and not only in our countries. But we're going into a quarter of a century or more where these people are going to be required to be bigger than we've needed for decades and decades.
Yeah. In your chapter on legitimacy, you have a quote from Bernard Williams, where he said the basic legitimation demand implies the state having to offer a justification of its power to each subject. When I read that quote, it made me smile, because it made me think of a conversation I had with a colleague a couple of years ago, where they asked me what I thought about the future of the Chinese state, and I told them that I think China will have great difficulty navigating the 21st century once their economy has sufficiently caught up Because, you know, in a low growth world, their citizens will become dissatisfied, and those who can afford to leave, perhaps will. And in your conclusion to the book, you talk about performance legitimacy. You say representative democracy does not depend wholly on output or performance legitimacy. And to the extent it does, it has insulation. Its secret ingredients is the way it separates how we feel about the government of the day from how we feel about the system of government. And you also talk about how the PRC puts heavy emphasis on performance legitimacy, which could be a source of fragility going forward. And you know, I just want to say this was hands down my favorite part of the book, because, you know, here in the U.S., we may outright despise our leaders in Congress or the person occupying the White House, but we have faith in the system because we can go to the polls and have our grievances heard. So it just seems to me, and correct me, you know, if I'm wrong here, that the PRC really needs to outperform and not just you know, economically, in order to continue with their existing social contract. Do you agree?
That's what I think. Yes, I think this point about representative democracy, the way it separates the way we feel about the government of the day from the way we feel about the system of government, I mean, it's just wonderful, actually. I mean, of course, it's not sufficient on our own. If in our societies, if the government changed, but things got worse and worse and worse in lots of respects that were salient and meaningful for regular people in their millions, then people would say, well, actually, it's not the party of government. We can't find a party to elect who's going to be able to fix this. It's got to be. This is when people start looking for a strong man.
Right.
You know, so, but nevertheless, our system is fantastic for that. And also it amounts to, this may be a bit more true in parliamentary democracies than in US-style democracies, but in degree it's true in the US too. It allows our systems to be trial and error. We try something, it doesn't work out very well, we kick them out, somebody else comes in. But all the time, this is under the constitutional system, that we can have huge rows about policy that don't infect what we feel about the system, which is ultimately about separation of powers, the integrity of the judiciary, and peaceful transfers of power. Right. China, you'd say, in a sense, has got all its eggs in one basket. Now, I think where I want to qualify the kind of optimistic tone, my own in the book, as well as yours interviewing me, is, well, they've got a long way to go before they catch up. You know, there's what economists call catch up is something where one would expect, as they adopt the best technology in the world, which they've done a great job of doing, one would expect them, their per capita GDP to continue to grow. And something I think that is tremendously important, something I'm slightly worried about, is I think it's perfectly plausible that over the next half decade or decade, you know, maybe starting tomorrow, the Chinese economy will stall. There are certain fragilities in its financial system and debt and imbalances and so on. And it could go through, let's say, a Japan-type experience when their debt bubble blew up. And I can imagine if that happens, and it certainly might, that people say, oh, well, back to normal. US-led world. And I would say that no, it's not like that. China is, if it has a bad decade, it'll be back. I mean, in the long struggle between Britain and France, you know, it ebbed and flowed. We had bad decades, they had bad decades. And ultimately, it was about allies and friends.
Right.
And if China grows, I mean, the silliest thing I've heard in the US, whether it's occasionally in Harvard or more frequently in Washington, which is, well, you know, we don't really, we can do this on our own, this struggle supremacy? To which the answer is, you might well be able to, but it's not remotely certain that you're able to. And if they grow, to be twice the size of you, my God, you will need allies and friends, just as my country did in that famous battlefield in 1815. I mean, and I'm not talking about war in this struggle, but just about, and this matters. So, you know, the book begins with someone walking into my office when I was at the Bank of England and saying, the Federal Reserve just refused India a swap line. This is in 2008 or 9 or something like that. And my response is, don't they understand India is going to be a power? Now, I don't know what the deliberation of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury of Washington and the White House was, but my first thought was about the 21st century and why irritate India unnecessarily?
Right.
Now, as it happens, that's all been undone, because I think the most important thing that happened in 2020 was not COVID, which, you know, was awful, but it was that China renewed the border skirmishes with India. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, India wanted to renew the security quad in the Pacific of the United States, Japan, India, and Australia. I think that's a historically massive moment.
Right.
So all this points to keep your friends and allies, and never forget that one doesn't need them every day, but some days one does.
Right. Right. Well, when we think about the future of World War II institutions, do those institutions rely on, does the future of those institutions rely on the PRC to stumble, or at least not become a dominant superpower?
They might rely on the US not stumbling badly. So I do think that the dollar is really important to the role of the United States in providing a security umbrella to large parts of the world and keeping the sea lanes open. Just as in the 19th century, the pound and the pound's attachment to gold was important to the British role. So I think this militates in terms of, you know, it really matters that the Federal Reserve does a good job. It matters that Congress understands that when they want to deregulate finance, that this is a foreign policy measure. That if you take certain measures that you think actually suit finance in the short run but might increase the risk of a crisis, that's a foreign policy measure. The within the Beltway thing that's going on as we speak about the debt ceiling, well, if the United States does end up, if that comes out in a way where the United States technically defaults, that's a foreign policy measure. It's not like doing this when there isn't a rival. But on the other side, yes. In a sense, I think the United States should plan on the basis that China doesn't make mistakes, and China should plan on the basis that China does make mistakes.
Right.
That's the prudent thing to do. And I think what will happen in some fields is that there will just be substitute international organizations. We've already seen this in development. Development is now a field where essentially it's not quite like the private sector, but each bloc has its own development bank.
Right.
I mean, what the World Bank has seems to, I don't write about the World Bank very much in the book, but what the World Bank has sustained is probably, it's probably still got critical mass in being the most interesting place that thinks about development issues.
Given what you just said, do you think that we are heading to a multipolar world with respect to our international institutions? You note in your chapter on fractured geopolitics that Neither the original GATT nor the reformed WTO regime catered for a giant economy with a completely different economic and political model. State-sponsored capitalism with subsidies to export-oriented and import-competing businesses and a single-party authoritarian government that can, among other things, control and direct the economy. Now, here you're of course talking about China. Do you think that China and others in the East will form their own institutional bloc and, you know, construct their own regional WTO, IMF, and World Bank?
Yes, I think they will try to. They've done that on the development front already. I think something very interesting has happened on the trade front. There's a China-led trade pact in Asia-Pacific, and then there's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which now has a slightly different name, that the United States was on course to be a member of and then withdrew from. I think that was a strategic mistake. I can't quite now see how either China or the US join that pact. And in that, you see, albeit in the economic sphere, almost the beginnings of some kind of non-aligned movement, which is, I can imagine being pleased that the United States, if you're one of the members, being pleased that the United States didn't join, because it enables them to plow their own furrow with neither of the superpowers there. And of course, I don't know what's going to happen, but I think all of these things, you know, regional trade pacts are now inflected with geopolitics, both what happens and what doesn't happen. But I would expect, I mean, if China ends up dominating the South China Sea and the East and the North China Sea, then I think we would just see the emergence of blocks. And the funnel between the two blocks might be broader than the thin tube that existed between the Soviet bloc and the Western bloc. But there would be blocks. And I think that could happen. But whether it does will depend partly on security issues. In all of this, I'm assuming, by the way, that there isn't some enormous social political dislocation in China. But I'm also assuming there isn't some enormous social political dislocation in the United States.
Right. So you know, moving on to shifting a bit. If we move on to developing a framework for engaging with these illiberal states, you say at the end of your chapter 12 that for the first time in a very long while, liberal states need a framework for policy towards illiberal superpowers, not sealed off in their own autarkic bloc. This considered, how do we in the West give China the respect it so desperately wants, while at the same time preserving Western values, strength, and leadership, and also not sacrificing economic well-being at home? Should we, I guess, amputate through economic sanctions states like China and others that have values and incentives that fail to align with our Western liberal construct, and in doing so, I guess, hope to pin them into autarky or force them to conform to our Western values? Or is this sort of a moot point, given that China will most certainly prove unyielding in its approach to human rights, which, you know, will present an unmovable political problem for the West? I mean, because you say in the book that even though some states might now reject the universalism of human rights on the grounds that they were codified under liberal Western hegemony, those norms can still be viewed as having made clear to ourselves as well as others the basis on which we believe international relations should proceed. So I want to get your thoughts on where do we sort of go from here with a framework.
this is where the rubber hits the road. And this is kind of where values meets power. But it isn't values kind of for their own sake, although they matter also for their own sake. It's that if at some point I say, if somebody, it doesn't have to be China, treat their own people like that, how would they treat us if they could? And one has to make a judgment about that. It's not inevitable that if a country treats its own people badly or some of its own people badly, they will treat others badly. I mean, you know, there have been over the last 70 years qualms in the US and in Europe about certain features of the US society, but we've never felt threatened by the US at all. So you have to make judgments. There's no, one of the themes of the book is there's no dodging judgments at all. In the sense it's not morality first, it's politics with values. I think it means that we shouldn't make ourselves overly dependent upon states that could be a serious threat to our way of life. And at one point, I can't remember your exact form of words, Edward, but it was like, you know, but actually this could cost us something in terms of income. And my answer is yes, it could. And we have to decide how much we're prepared to pay. Because this would be, if we do become overdependent, we'd be better off in the short run and maybe worse off in the medium to long run. And this doesn't matter to anybody other than me. The meat of this book was written before COVID, and it was written before the war against Ukraine. And what both episodes have taught us is don't be over-dependent upon potentially unfriendly states, most obviously for energy, but also for kind of crucial medical kit. So this is, you know, one of the things that came out of COVID was too much emphasis on just in time and not enough emphasis on just in case. Now, but for those of your listeners that think it should be about economics and say, well, actually, we lose some efficiency by doing that. Well, a business person's idea of efficiency is just in time in the short run. An economist's idea of efficiency matters in all states of the world, bad as well as good. I mean, the problem we discovered with just-in-time is it's all terribly well when things are going well. And actually, it's all really bad when things are going badly. when things are badly, you want your system to be resilient.
Right.
Things are badly because of the plague, as I casually call it, because of the pandemic. And yet it turned out that just when we needed resilience in certain of our systems, trade systems, supply systems, it wasn't there. That is inefficient.
to be sure.
So, you know, including we can't get any protective gear because it's all manufactured somewhere else, or we can research on vaccines, but we can't actually make them because that's done somewhere else. Now, I'm at risk of repeating myself because all these arguments are connected, of course. But so we need to be less overly dependent, but only pull back as much as we need to. And the same goes for them, by the way. This is asymmetric. In a sense, I don't think we are safer if they are overly dependent on us.
Right, right.
Because that would make them more aggressive in certain circumstances. And they are going to, if not today, you know, within 20 years, they might have more aircraft carriers than we have. And, you know, that's not a crazy planning assumption. But I think this business of basic human rights, I really mean the most basic human rights that are part of positive international law, the peremptory norms against genocide and slavery and so on, the really, really awful things. I think they became part of who we think we are in the middle of the 20th century because of the horrors committed in Europe against people. And, you know, this was an epoch-making tragedy. But I think it now forms part of our identity. And people can have legitimate arguments about whether X or Y are human rights, things to do with education or whatever. But actually, there are certain things about imprisoning whole groups of people or enslaving groups of old people. We say, no, you can't. And if people do, it's not that necessarily we want to go in and change it because we don't have the power to.
Right.
But we ought to, you know, it fits with thinking, you know, if they can treat their own people like that, how might they treat us?
Right, right. Well, I guess knowing that we're operating with quite distinct frameworks of leadership, what are the criteria upon which we should decide whether to delegate authority to an international organization? Can you walk us through your principles for participation and delegation? Because this is going to be key over the next few decades, you know, essentially giving our power to some of these institutions to in hopes that they will, you know, carry out our intent.
I'll give just a couple that I think are linked, if I may, and I think kind of bring together some of our discussion. One is, we shouldn't be casually pooling power or delegating power where there's some kind of meaningful chance that that could be really damaging to order and legitimacy at home. The order and legitimacy at home is, you know, this is a hell of an achievement. And we take it for granted because in the West, we've had it for hundreds of years. And other parts of the world haven't had it. But, you know, when it, there's God doesn't gift this to us. And I think concretely, this business, which we've touched on a couple of times, of setting up international organizations where everybody has a veto on pretty well everything, can seem a really liberal thing to do for obvious reasons. It's kind of, for those of you that follow the literature, this is a kind of Pareto type.
Right.
But if in a world of asymmetric power, if another superpower rises, and actually the two superpower powers can't bargain their way out of the problem because everybody's got a veto, that's a prescript. Giving everyone a veto is basically saying everything's going to be nice. That actually all the disagreements are going to be about small things rather than about big things. Or, you know, war is never going to be at stake. I mean, I was slightly surprised about this myself until I realized it was essential that, I mean, I started writing a book about international organizations, and it has substantial patches about war and peace and the laws of the sea and things like that. And actually, it's because I recognize that these are important, that peace will go into existence. Order is a precondition for everything else, including the international things that I used to do. And so the biggest prescription is remember that and don't make it harder for powers to bargain their way out of a problem. You know, and that means, for example, that we shouldn't set up regimes where dispute resolution is in the hands of arm's length judges, and that's okay in itself. And that there's no way one should never want to overrule their decisions. That's backward looking. But there's no way of setting a different forward looking path if they raise decisions that actually the main powers or some of the smaller powers just can't accept. It's I think those are almost the most important things in the book, and many people hold up the World Trade regime as the, you know, the absolute epicenter of globalization, and it is, but actually it's sclerotic because it was drafted as though it was perfect. Well, you know, that wasn't very sensible. And actually, you know, I don't think one needs any hindsight to think that. I think it was a moment of conceit, not collective conceit. I don't mean any individuals were conceited about it. It was too hopeful. Hope's a good thing, but one can be too hopeful.
Yeah. Well, if we look to the future, you talk a bit about the need for legitimacy within and among states, and particularly the need for legitimacy for maintaining order. You say powers will be interested in each other's stability, since internal instability could spill over into the international arena. You then go on to touch on immigration a bit, and you say, given that mass migration, whether spontaneous or widespread, might prove the greatest source of 21st century disorder. This responsibility is no small matter. Do you think that, I mean, do you feel that migration maybe could become much more weaponized in the coming days than it has been? And what, I guess, what would that look like? And you know, what impacts could that have?
So I think yes, but even before we get to it being weaponized, let me give you an example of climate change. I think one of the mistakes that perhaps with hindsight climate change campaigners have made is that atmospherically they've made it feel like a left-wing thing. Now imagine that what they say about climate change and the damage it could unleash on the world is exactly right. So it's important in this that I'm accepting the terms of their argument. So if that were to happen, there would be absolutely mass migration from some parts of the world to others, perhaps on a scale that hasn't been seen for over 1,000 years in Eurasia, and perhaps even longer in the Americas. Well, people on the right, even if they are not narrow, exceptional racists, etc., people on the right might reasonably object to that because of the threatened dislocation to their own societies and the threat of disorder in their own societies. So climate change would be a thing where actually the left and right ought to be able to agree if they focus on the consequences, not on the causes, or even more, on the bundle of other issues that climate change tends to come with. It actually doesn't need to be bundled up with anything else. You know, it's a thing in itself, if right. It is a thing in itself. So I think, and in those circumstances, there would be, I've done that in a kind of domestic sense, but also the rich countries of the world have an interest in helping the poorer countries in the world, because, you know, parts of the world may become effectively uninhabitable economically, and that could threaten the order in the rich part of the world, and the rich part of the world would do better to help everybody cope with it in advance by reducing its likelihood. Now, this is also a bridge into weaponization, because you can imagine if something like the scenario I just painted did occur, well, people would be kind of opportunistically weaponizing it in those circumstances. But I think the burden of your question was, might people try to weaponize it, you know, almost ab initio? Could they provide the shock? Yes. I mean, that's part of what the struggle in Syria was about. And another part, in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa as well, that it, the threat of migration inevitably now becomes part of navigating conflict. So yes. And I think it's a very big thing. I mean, big migrations in the past have transformed the world.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways. I mean, one doesn't have to attribute the fall of the Roman Empire entirely to that, but it played a part in that. And basically, you know, press pause for 400 years in terms of, which is really, I mean, that's longer than the life of the United States to date.
Right.
So yes. And, you know, this is part of a broader theme that for different reasons with today's technology, almost anything can be weaponized. I mean, political scientists have been focusing on that a lot over the last 2 to 3 years. But actually, policymakers always knew this. When the international payment system, SWIFT, was used for sanctions, heads of government tended to think that that was great, and central bankers tended to think, oh, a Pandora's box is being opened.
Right.
And, you know, there's a latency in all of these things. If you have interconnections, well, you can use those interconnections in hostile ways as well as friendly ways, in defense or in attack. And that's one of the things that we will eventually live through is an absolutely giant cyber attack.
Yeah.
And somehow we need the main powers. I mean, this is all becomes part of peaceful coexistence. Peaceful coexistence is not just my troops don't meet your troops in some ocean or some landmass, but I don't switch off your peninsula.
Right. True. You know, I wanted to pick your brain because we've sort of talked a little bit about Britain during the 19th century. We saw how Britain's wealth increased quite substantially during the first globalization of the 19th century. Britain invested abroad, and the profits from those investments were remitted back home. They were the superpower of the time, but if we fast forward to the 20th century, Britain lost her standing as a result of the borrowing that occurred in the First and Second World Wars. And if we juxtapose that with the development and rise of the U.S.'s financial footprint, one could pin the U.S.'s rise to influence on its vast lending programs for those wars, and it maintaining dollar parity between wars. So, you know, considering this, do you feel that there's any possibility that the U.S. could sort of follow the path of Britain and lose its standing as the global financial hegemon, given how much it is borrowing and has been borrowing abroad? Or do you feel that since the dollar is the global reserve currency and most countries negotiate their contracts in dollars, that there remains little threat that the U.S. will lose its position as the global financial superpower? I mean, it certainly helps that the people from whom we borrow from, they sort of have a penchant for investing those returns back into U.S. treasuries and back into the United States, and essentially rolling over much of our debt. But this may not be the case, you know, 3 or 4 decades from now. So what do you think? What are you saying?
So I think this is a really, really important issue, and the question is very well posed, if I may say so. So the first thing to say is a very big contrast between the decline of British power and the rise of American power is, to put it in this slightly frivolous terms, this was inconvenient for Britain, but it wasn't a disaster. You are, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Britain's spell at the top, if you like, is although scholars rightly say we live in a world of international institutions largely designed by the US, those institutions largely function in a world that were created by Britain's commitment to free trade and monetary stability in the 19th century. The extent to which it's hardly for a Brit to say, really, but the extent to which the world is still living in the echoes of 19th century, early 20th century Britain is quite striking. But the most important of which was the next superpower had some affinity with Europe. It had come out of Europe in some respects, different in some respects, but similar in others. Well, if there is a new superpower now, there isn't some kind of new American Anglo-European state popping up, unless Australia population suddenly increases rather. That's not going to happen. So I think the stakes are higher. It's the first thing to say. Second thing to say is you have, quite apart from, you have some advantages that we didn't have. And I don't just mean the vast landmass of the United States and the two oceans that separate you from the rest of the world. I think that too many people make too much of the two oceans. If the rest of the world became the habitat of another rival power, I do not think it would be terribly comfortable retreating in a Jeffersonian kind of way to American pastoralism. I don't think you would enjoy that, largely because I think many of the elites would move eventually. But there's something else, which is that the World Monetary Order, of which London was, in some senses, the center, had this brittleness in it because of the attachment to gold. Mm-hmm. And my own view of the unraveling of Britain in the early part of the 20th century, when it went back onto gold to higher a parity, was partly what the people concerned hadn't grasped, is they had been born in a world of with democracy, but without full franchise democracy. Whereas they were taking those decisions in a world of full franchise democracy. And I think the British population simply wouldn't bear the volatility in jobs and economic activity that their predecessors in the 19th century had taken for granted. Now, I think that leads to two places for the United States. First of all, you're not attached to gold. To the extent that the dollar holds its value, that's through the work of the Federal Reserve. I'll come back to that. But the other is that the tale of my country, if I'm right, that it's partly about full franchise democracy, it shows how domestic equability, order, legitimacy actually really matters.
Right.
And so the strains in the United States really matter. And here I'm reminded of the 1970s, and I want to give a concrete example. So the United States is in a mess. Bretton Woods falls apart, and it's in a mess because people think that you're not going to be able to hold the dollar's parity against gold, given the costs of the Vietnam War and the costs of social welfare that you've introduced so as to cushion the domestic response to the Vietnam War. And that takes a couple of decades, really, to repair until Paul Volcker and Alan Greenspan do their thing. But there's an episode in the middle of the 1970s where a delegation from Washington, I think the State Department and Treasury, but I forget the details, go together to Saudi Arabia, essentially for a bargain. This is the second grand bargain of the post-Second World War order, which is, you can provide more security and arms sales, etc., but won't they continue, please, invoicing oil in dollars? And, you know, the day in which a major oil supplier starts invoicing in renminbi, this will be a massive, massive day. So that says two things, all told. First of all, is that the Federal Reserve isn't just an enormously important institution organization for stabilizing the economy and keeping inflation low in terms of domestic prosperity, although it is massively that.
Right.
It's that if they screw up or if they are undermined by Congress or whoever, that will weaken the dollar's position in the world. And everything's relative, so that will strengthen the position of the renminbi. And, you know, we've seen important meetings in the Gulf in the last few weeks. I mean, relationships will be forged, and a challenge to a kind of liberal realist approach to all these things is that one must draw some lines about the horrors of other countries and not being over-dependent upon them, but also accept that we need to be a kind of accommodate friendships with states we don't completely approve. And that's why this presents great challenges to statesmanship. I do want to say one more thing on this, which is that it really does underline, your question underlines the importance of banking stability and stability in your shadow banking sector as well. Since the global financial crisis, the United States and my country have done a good job on the banking sector, but a pretty useless job actually on shadow banking. And that's because lobbyists stop anyone doing about it. And if the shadow banking sector blows up, and it's small, won't matter. If the shadow banking sector blows up, as it might, and is large, the stakes are not just a dislocation in growth in the economy for a few years. This will be a, you know, in Game of Snakes and Ladders, this will be a bad snake to slip down. It's not a, you know, no one should be surprised that Beijing thought that Western powers are declining, Eastern powers are rising after the last financial crisis. Who can blame them for thinking that? Well, let's not have another financial crisis.
Yeah. Well, I guess for the big question now is, can the international economic and legal system survive today's fractured geopolitics, given everything we've talked about today? Should we in the West operate under Rawls's notion that, difficult though it may be, the present enemy must be seen as a future associate in a shared and just peace? Or should we take a different approach?
One should take, I mean, I'm critical of Rawls in the book in various places, because I don't think Rawls, I think the Law of Peoples is in many respects his best book, but I don't think it occurred to him that you could have a massive superpower that wasn't liberal or decent by hand.
Right.
I think there are great lessons in the beginning of the 19th century after the Napoleonic Wars, and then again after the Second World War. In the first case, having France back in to the top table almost immediately. In the second case, Germany and Japan. The lesson the other way is Versailles after the First World War, alienating Central and European and Eastern European states. I do, but the maxims that come out of that don't just apply for war. It's that I think that trade, David Hume runs through my book. I think that commerce, commercial society, does broaden our sense of we, but in slow motion. And so I think we should expect these people to be allies and friends eventually, and hope that that will be true of their attitude to us. But that doesn't preclude caution in the short run. You know, the best way to handle a very difficult neighbor isn't necessarily to say, well, I'm going to treat them as though they've already become my best friend. It's, you know, a long-term project to kind of... This is what happened with Britain and France. I mean, in the 19th century, after fighting each other for 100-odd years, in the 19th century, we, Britain, absorbed some of their values of equality and democracy. But they absorbed some of our values of constitutionalism and constraints on an overmighty state. And, you know, I've got no idea what will happen over the next 100 years, but we should not be irrevocably hostile, but we should be cautious. I mean, this is a one-party state that thinks about itself and the world in a very different way that our history leads us to think. And one doesn't have that is no animus to the Chinese people or Chinese history and traditions, which I think are rather remarkable, but so are ours. And we want to hold on to ours.
For sure. Well, Sir Tucker, thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned so very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Well, thank you, Edward, for having me on. It's been a real treat.
Well, that's it for us here at The Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with our very special guest, Sir Paul Tucker. Make sure to check out all the episodes of The Demand Side on The Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us today. And remember, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose The Demand Side. Until next time.